Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week, on November 11th, we celebrate Veterans Day. Originally established in 1918 to commemorate the armistice which ended World War I, today it is a national holiday honoring veterans of the armed services throughout our history. In recognition of Veterans Day, Talking History's Jim Madison will be interviewing Peter Shrivers on his new book, The GI War Against Japan, American Soldiers in Asia and the Pacific During World War II. And after that, Harvey Shapiro will join us to talk about the poets of World War II and read selections from their work. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on November 12, 1815, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was born in Johnstown, New York. Stanton was a leader in the women's rights movement who devoted her life to winning women's right to vote and to a higher education, access to the professions, the right to own property, and their right to divorce. In 1840, she married anti-slavery activist Henry Stanton, but refused to use the word obey in the marriage ceremony. In 1851, she met and began a lifelong collaboration with fellow reformer Susan B. Anthony. As one observer described it, Stanton was the brains of the new association. Anthony was its hands and feet. In 1892, at age 77, Stanton delivered a speech on the natural rights of woman to the Committee of the Judiciary of the United States Congress. The strongest reason for giving women all the opportunities for higher education, for the full development of all her faculties, for her emancipation from all forms of bondage, of custom, dependence, and superstition, and from all the crippling influences of fear, she concluded, is the solitude and personal responsibility of her own individual life. Elizabeth Cady Stanton died in 1902.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a proposal to have the bodies of 8 Confederate sailors lie in state in the South Carolina Capitol in Columbia has caused a stir. As reported on this show, the sailors' remains were recovered 3 years ago when the submarine H.L. Hunley was brought up from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, where it sank shortly after defeating the Union blockade ship Housatonic in 1864. The Hunley was the first submarine to sink an enemy ship during the war. Critics of the proposal to have the Confederate sailors lie in state argue that those who fought to preserve slavery ought not to be so honored. Those in favor counter that these men died in defense of their country for what they believed was a just cause, and that they deserve as much honor and dignity in their burial as any other soldier killed in action. This is Talking History. For this, our Veterans Day program, Talking History's Jim Madison, Professor of History at Indiana University, decided to focus on soldiers and their experiences in war, or more particularly, the GI experience in World War II. He discussed that subject with his guest this week, Peter Shrivers.
If there was ever any doubt that war is hell, the largest and most destructive war in human history proved the point. World War II was hell for all participants in Europe, and especially so in the Pacific theater. Our guest today on Talking History is Dr. Peter Shrivers, who is lecturer in the history of U.S. foreign relations at the Graduate Institute of International Studies in Geneva, Switzerland. Dr. Shivers is the author of The GI War Against Japan, American Soldiers in Asia and the Pacific During World War II, recently published by New York University Press. Welcome, Peter Shivers.
Welcome, Jim.
Let me open our conversation by quoting America's great war correspondent, Ernie Pyle. "Covering the war in the Pacific was for me," Pyle wrote, "like learning to live in a new city. The methods of war, the attitude toward it, the homesickness, the distances, and the climate, everything was different from what we had known in the European war." Can you provide us with just one example of what Ernie Pyle meant, why the Asian Pacific War was so different from the European War?
I think something that truly sticks out, Jim, is that tremendous sense of isolation that the GIs experienced over there. A loneliness, a tremendous loneliness. Another famous correspondent over there, Ira Wolford, traveled to the Solomon Islands in the Southwest Pacific in 1942, and he went by bomber, looked at the ocean for hours, and by the time he arrived in the Solomons, he wrote back home and said, you know, these soldiers are experiencing a loneliness that cannot be imagined, he said. So loneliness coupled with, I think, a bottomless monotony, to the point where in one memoir that I found written by a battalion surgeon who lived for several months in New Guinea, the island of New Guinea in the Southwest Pacific, who titled one of his chapters in the memoir, a chapter of close to 30 pages, and he titled it Boredom.
That's part of the reality, and we want to get more into the reality of what American GIs experienced in the Pacific. But what were their preconceptions before they got to Asia, before they got to the Pacific? What did American GIs expect to find there?
Well, that's kind of interesting. When I started researching the book, I'd never imagined that I'd be writing a large part on their experience entitled Frontier. They developed a series of reflexes, really, a pioneer reflex and a romantic reflex when they went into the Pacific. A pioneer reflex in the sense that they expected Asia and the Pacific to be, in a way, a continuation of their own far west. So this would be a new west they were going into, full of promises of virgin land, a resource frontier of gold and oil and huge markets, the Chinese one, for instance. But also a romantic reflex, and I think a reflex that can be called romantic for two reasons. Their ideas of Asia and the Pacific were, first of all, not based on facts. And secondly, they were, to a large extent, idealizations. And these came from, I think, very obviously from the mass media and mass entertainment. These GIs had based their ideas of Asia and the Pacific on a whole series of movies, books, movies, for instance, on the Pacific, the movies with actress Dorothy Lamour, whom they really loved, but played in movies on the Pacific that were romances, love stories, on exotic islands. They'd read books, for instance, like the books on China by Pearl S. Buck, which portrayed the Chinese peasants almost as Jeffersonian Democrats, peace-loving farmers, etc. So idealizations, and of course they were greatly disappointed by the time they actually arrived there, both in terms of the area's nature and the area's people.
So the preconception certainly did not fit the reality. Dorothy Lamour was not what they found when they got the Pacific. What did they find? What was the reality?
Well, there's a reality of the nature they encounter, and there's a reality of the people they see. In terms of nature, it's interesting. You know, these GIs, they were all given a series of army booklets describing the area they were going to in simplified terms. And the guide they received on New Guinea, an island in the Southwest Pacific, said to the GIs, well, keep in mind that the Japanese are not going to be your only enemy on this island. They're not even going to be your worst enemy. It's the island itself that will fight you with all its forces.
For example, what? What about the island of New Guinea would fight?
First of all, certainly the climate. Climate would attack everything, a combination of heat and humidity that would attack equipment, clothing, and the skin itself, skin that was easily infected over there, something which the GIs after a while started calling jungle rot, the actual rotting of the skin if you weren't very careful. And even if you were, it would happen eventually anyway. So things like that would really get to the GIs, certainly after having been on the island for several months. Another problem, disease, of course. This was a disease environment. Insects carrying microorganisms that in turn would cause a whole series of diseases. Sticking out, of course, malaria. And you have to keep in mind, for instance, that in the Southwest Pacific, specifically on the island of New Guinea, malaria throughout the war would cause more casualties than did the Japanese. In terms of the people they met, we can make a distinction between the people living there and then the enemy they were fighting, the Japanese soldiers. Certainly, in terms of the Japanese soldier whom they met, and it doesn't apply only to the Japanese soldiers, but to Asians and Pacific Islanders in general. First of all, they felt threatened by these people, threatened in a variety of ways. In the instance where they did live in areas of habitation, let's say, they were very much impressed by the fact that there were so many people, certainly in the China-Burma-India theater, for instance, but also on certain larger islands. They noticed high rates of fertility, these compressed masses, which brought back to memory older fears of yellow peril, Asian hordes washing away Western civilization, for instance. A second problem certainly also applies to the Japanese soldier. They were intimidated by the mentality of the people they faced. One of the GI booklets again said, you know, we're fighting the Japanese, and the Japanese understand war in Asia, which implied that, you know, Americans don't really understand war in Asia. Right. These people are fit to fight a war in primitive environments, in jungle environments, and we have to be very careful with that. And soldiers definitely, after a couple of months, started agreeing with that, assigning the Japanese primitive, almost animal-like qualities, in the jungle even ape-like qualities.
Does this get us to the point then of what you call the ever-escalating fury on the part of American GIs?
Yes, it certainly does, because the series of frustrations that developed overseas in Asia and the Pacific, whether emanating from nature or the enemy they were facing, the human enemy they were facing, what you get is this becomes a war of savagery, and in response to it, the Americans themselves become, to an extent, are forced to become savages themselves simply to survive this war. Let me give you one example.
Can you give us some examples, please, of that savagery?
Yes. An example comes very early in the war, Guadalcanal, in 1942. The first weeks the battle there is being fought, there is the incident of the Gutke patrol, a patrol of 25 GIs, who think a group of Japanese soldiers are trying to surrender. They're waving white flags, etc. So they step forward, you take them prisoner, and then all of a sudden the Japanese open up with their rifles, they bayonet the Americans, they kill them. So that spreads, that story spreads very rapidly throughout the Southwest Pacific, and from then on the Americans say, well, it's either kill or be killed. No quarter taken. That's the way we will have to fight this war. And this is just one incident, but there are a series of incidents like that. To the point where at the end of the war, Lindbergh, the famous aviator traveling around the Pacific, says, you know, his conclusion is that Americans are fighting the Japanese, you know, treat the Japanese, he says, with less respect than they would give an animal.
So what does this mean about prisoners of war on both sides, Japanese and American?
Prisoners of war, no quarter taken. Again, as I said, it becomes very hard on both sides to find POWs. On the American side, the armed forces reach a point where commanders have to issue orders telling American soldiers to please take prisoners, because we need these people for information, valuable information. Comes to a point where certain commanders in certain areas say, well, listen, if you, you know, take in a prisoner, a Japanese prisoner, we'll give you a case of beer.
Really?
We'll give you a bottle of whiskey, some ice cream, but please bring in prisoners.
So they're bribing American GIs to take Japanese prisoners rather than to kill them.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, it comes to that point.
One of the clear advantages the Americans had in this war, of course, was a massive industrial and technological superiority over Japan especially. Can we talk about that a little bit, some evidence of that, some consequences of that in this war?
Yes, certainly. America's industrial and technological power are crucial, of course, for them to win this war. And really, there is a polarizing of national identities on the Japanese and the American side throughout the war based on their what they emphasize as their unique qualities. For the Japanese, that is what the Japanese call seishin, or spirit, you know, almost a mystic virtue that will enable them to overcome American material wealth. For the Americans, on the other hand, they're proud of that material wealth, of their industrial and technological power. And so they're going to emphasize in the warfare they're conducting exactly that aspect of their society.
In order to save American lives as a consequence, is that?
Exactly. Yes. And that's why they're going to especially emphasize, of course, air power. And GIs, even on the ground combat soldiers, you know, gradually start realizing that they're cheering on islands when they see the B-29s pass over their heads, cheering loudly, because they know that eventually, especially that kind of power, America's air power, is going to win the war, whether in a tactical sense or, as with the B-29s, in a strategic sense. They read, of course, in the few newspapers that they eventually do get in the front lines, they read about the bombings, of fire bombings especially, of, for instance, Tokyo. There is the example of the Tokyo raid in March, in which in a single day 15 square miles are destroyed, 250,000 buildings, and most importantly in terms of human cost, 90,000 people. GIs read about it and they cheer this. You know, they know that that's what's going to bring them victory.
Do they react in the same way to the news of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
That's an interesting question. I was struck by the fact that by the time they hear about the usage of the atomic bombs, they have become so inured, let's say, against, you know, they use this constant escalation in violence, like the Tokyo bombing raid of March, 90,000 people, that by the time they hear about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they don't really see it as this kind of exceptional weapon. It's just the next step up that ladder of, you know, the escalation and the attritional use of military weaponry. And you find soldiers in their diaries writing, oh yes, we heard about the bomb thrown on Hiroshima, and next to that a line saying, oh, by the way, I lost my fountain pen today.
So
Nothing more particular about it than that.
It's no big deal. It's just another way of saving American lives.
Exactly. That's exactly what it has become to them.
Do you think that Americans today understand this war in the Pacific, that they understand the differences between Europe and the Pacific War?
I don't think so. I don't think they understand it enough, to the frustration I've noticed of veterans who have fought in that particular war, in that particular region. Much less is being published on the Pacific War than there is on Europe. And I've felt, talking to veterans, that they feel misunderstood and worse, neglected, as far as their part in the war is concerned, which is one of the reasons why I undertook writing this book after having done one on Europe. And also, I think people fail to see the continuity there is between, you know, a string of America's Asian wars. There are striking parallels, I think, between the war in the Pacific and, say, the Philippine War at the beginning of the 20th century, or the
yes.
Korean, and even the war in Vietnam. And that, I think, people forget about it often.
Why this neglect of the Pacific War?
I'm not entirely certain. I think people perhaps have the feeling that the war was won in Europe and that therefore that's the war that counts. Perhaps also, I don't know, I'm just guessing here, but perhaps because there is a closer affinity with what, you know, for most Americans still is a more familiar
right.
culture, the European one.
Right.
Perhaps that's one of the reasons. I'm not entirely sure.
That's really very interesting to think about. Thank you, Peter. Our guest today has been Peter Shrivers, talking about his new book, The GI War Against Japan, American Soldiers in Asia and the Pacific During World War II. Thank you.
To conclude our Veterans Day program, we take the unusual step, for us anyway, of turning to poetry to gain some insights into the minds of those who go to war. We asked Harvey Shapiro to talk about the poets of World War II and to read some brief selections from their work. Harvey Shapiro is a World War II veteran. He served in the Army Air Force and flew 35 combat missions over Central Europe. He's also the author of 11 books of poetry, to which he recently added his edited collection, Poets of World War II. In describing this book, Shapiro commented, "This is not a book of celebration, unless it is to celebrate man's ability, indeed his compulsion, to turn terror into art."
World War II marked the beginning of the American century, as Henry Luce called it, in the title of a book published in 1941. Toward the end of the war, Walter Lippmann wrote, "What Rome was to the ancient world, what Great Britain has been to the modern world, America is to be to the world of tomorrow." With the collapse of the Soviet Union, we seem for the first time to be strenuously caught in the drama of that American century. I believe that is why there is such interest today in World War II as a turning point in our history and in the men and women who participated in it. We learned about the past from our professional historians, but also from our novelists and poets. The novelists of World War II, Mailer, Vonnegut, Styron, Wook, Jones, James Jones, are well known. The poets are mostly unknown. It is their testimony I want to examine now. They are unknown because they have been so overshadowed by the English poets of World War I, Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, Robert Graves, Edmund Blunden, Isaac Rosenberg. In his classic anthology, Up the Line to Death, The War Poets, 1914-1918, the English historian Brian Gardner singled out as a defining characteristic of these English poets their sense of themselves as a brotherhood. Even before the war, according to Gardner, they thought themselves a generation marked off for great things, and afterwards they remained a brotherhood of those who were there. There is no such feeling among the American poets of World War II. But of course the English poets, officers all, belonged in a sense, with the exception of Rosenberg, to the same gentleman's club. The American poets, many of them enlisted men, did not. Even after the savage battles of the Somme, when the tenor of their poetry changed, the English poets continued to celebrate the glory of their brotherhood. For the most part, the American poets write in quite a different tone. Their poems are often bawdy, bitchy, irreverent. They do not glory in brotherhood, and they do not, as a rule, find nobility in one another. Quite the contrary, they often dislike being put cheek by jowl alongside one another. If they are enlisted men in the infantry, they bear no love for their officers. Surprisingly, even those men in bomber crews, which were, after all, small, intensely coordinated units, could feel alien from one another. Nor do these poets sound the kind of sonorous note exemplified by John McCrae's In Flanders Fields, the single poem from the First World War that everyone involved in the Second had grown up with. "To you from falling hands we throw, the torch be yours to hold it high." Or by Rupert Brooke's The Soldier, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England." The American poets of World War II wrote poems that are neither pious nor patriotic. They viewed themselves as individuals caught in a giant machine that was so complex and far-flung, the mind could not encompass it. They were astonished at the way their lives had been altered. The way trench warfare dominates the imagery of World War I, the fleets of bombers and the smoking cities dominate the imagery of World War II. Out of that new war in the air, a clean war, as one of the poets says, because the dead rarely bothered coming home to die, came the most famous poem of the conflict, The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner by Randall Jarrell. Jarrell enlisted in the Air Corps in 1942, but washed out of pilot training and became an instructor trainer at a field in Tucson, Arizona, for the rest of the war. When I first read the concluding line of his famous poem, "When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose," I remembered an incident from my aerial gunnery school training in Yuma, Arizona. An instructor returned from flying his missions over Germany with the English-based 8th Air Force, was standing before a mock-up of a B-17 explaining the different positions. When he came to the ball turret, he said offhandedly, "Sometimes when they return from a mission, they have to wash him out of the turret with a hose." Jarrell may well have heard that line delivered just the way I did, and then he put it to great use. The civilian poets, who were too old to serve, greet the war without enthusiasm, and that's a reflection of the climate of opinion that preceded Pearl Harbor and our entry into it. Most Americans were wary of getting involved in what they perceived to be a power struggle among Europeans. Some of these poets write about segregation in the American Army. The Army during World War II was completely segregated in a system that was as rigid and bizarre as segregation in the American South. One example, I was a gunner in an all-white B-17 crew flying out of southern Italy. All the combat crewmen in my bomb group were white. Yet frequently over our targets in Germany, we were protected by black pilots from an all-black P-51 fighter group, also stationed in southern Italy. We met only in the air. We were victorious, but 400,000 of us died in that war. So the sight of dead bodies is scattered among the poems of the American poets, the way bodies were washed up on invasion beaches or left as markers along the trail to show the new infantrymen moving forward, the face of death.
You've been listening to Harvey Shapiro, veteran and poet, and the editor of Poets of World War II, published by the Library of America. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We invite your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History and the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.